There we go.
It's 7 p.m. Thursday, and this is All About Wine. With All About Wine's resident wine expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida.
First, we were talking last week about Asian wineries and Asian grapes. We're going to finish up Australia today. That's what we're doing with the France. So we're continuing with France. Tonight. Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly. Mike and I were talking about the possibilities of hooking up with different wineries in different states and finding out what's going on. Sounds like it might be a whole lot of fun.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery in Basser, Kansas.
Organic Farm on the coast of Maine near Mount Desert Island.
Westport Rivers, Westport, Mass.
Haverhill.com. The Napa Valley of the Midwest.
RainbornWines.com. In Santa Rosa.
Ten Spoon in Montana.
Alba Vineyards.
We're the largest estate vineyard in New Jersey.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery. New Jersey's top-rated winery for 2011.
India Vineyards on Route 93 at the main highway coming right up the center of New Hampshire out of Massachusetts.
Bebock Winery. We are actually the highest-rated red wines in New Mexico.
Well, Southwest Wine is actually located in Deming, New Mexico.
Well, La Viña is the oldest winery in New Mexico.
Castello di Borghese, the first winery established in Long Island.
Blackhead Lake Winery, and we're located at Crusher Park in Montana.
Mammoth Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Brotherhood is America's oldest winery since 1839.
Ithaca, New York, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
The website is freethegrapes.org.
All right, grab a phone and let's talk about wine tonight. Dial area code 646-727-3235. That's 646-727-3235. All right, let's start the show and let's talk about wine.
Us people, right?
Absolutely. They're enjoying this extremely warm, sunny weather that we're having here. Oh, and by the way, I have two things about that intro. First off, make sure you grab your own phone when you call us. And, you know, if you do grab somebody else's phone, I hope you know them well enough that you can grab their phone and use it.
Don't
grab a stranger's phone when you call us, okay? Because don't want that coming back. Also, the second thing is all those people doing their introductions and their names and everything, I'm going to say that's less than half of the guests that we have had on here, because that's like part two. I made one last year, and it covered a whole line of guests that we've had. And that one, again, I mean, we could just go on with the people, the great wine representatives and industry reps and everything that we've had on the show to come on here. That would run for – that could be its own intro right there, just having them come on and, you know, this is, you know, that kind of thing. It's fantastic how many special guests we've had on here. And I don't even think that makes half of them that you hear on the intro now. So that's wonderful.
It really is. Every time I hear that, I'm always just amazed at all the different people we've talked to, all the people that have been willing to come on and talk to us, and some of the great information we've had, too. It's just...
It's fantastic.
Willing to share a lot of stuff with us and all that, and it really is fantastic. So stay tuned. We're not done yet. We got more. In fact, we might back up at the end here and go back to some of the early stage, which... we weren't calling, and seeing if they can come on and see if we can't get some of the earlier states to come on the air with us. We do have
one tonight, so that'll be cool.
We do, yeah. We have a guest from Pennsylvania tonight, and next week, I don't know, next week we might have a problem getting a guest on from Pennsylvania. And the reason is that the East Coast is having their biggest wine show of the year next weekend, or next week. I can't think of the name of it right now. But it's I was going to look it up too before the program tonight, so I can talk about it a little bit. Not that I get any credit or any monies for talking about it, but I should.
Is that the one here, or is it where's it located?
This show, it's a great big show. It used to be held in Pennsylvania every year. This year, it's being held in Richmond, Virginia. And it's big. I went to it a couple years ago. It's just phenomenal. They have all sorts of speakers there from all over the country. They have representatives for all sorts of different stuff. all sorts of different stuff related to the wine industry. And let me punch in here. And
it's
see
not the it's not the expo, is it? See, there's something else here.
Is New Jersey Junior Wine Festival? No.
No, that was in February.
Yeah.
That was tickets on sale.
But I can't think of the name. I've got a blank, and I'm sure all you need to do is just ask anybody that's, you know, or if anybody's listening out there right now. Wineries Unlimited Conference. That's what it is. Wineries Unlimited.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Wineries Unlimited Trade Show and Conference. It's being held in Richmond, Virginia this year. In the past, it was held in King of Prussia in Pennsylvania. Mm. And so it outgrew that. I attended up there in King of Prussia a couple years ago, and it has outgrown that. It's an enormous show. It brings in vendors from all over the country selling just about everything you can imagine associated with wine. It brings in people from not just the East Coast, but really just about everywhere in the country. They have special guests, they have speakers, they have auctions, they have special dinners. It really is a great show. If anyone, and it doesn't have to be just for wine people, it could be for anyone out there. So if anyone out there is interested in hearing speakers, interested in going to workshops, if you're a home winemaker, whatever you do, it is a great convention to attend. It's the biggest on the East Coast. They have a lot of big shows going on out in the West Coast of the United States, obviously because of California and Oregon, Washington. But this is the big one here on the East Coast. So if you are, well, you don't have to live on the East Coast to attend it either. But it starts on Monday, March the 26th, and that's early restoration. Tuesday restoration's open, and first workshop is from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wednesday, the 28th, it continues with all sorts of the trade show opens and all sorts of seminars and focus on enology and marketing. And that evening they have a big dinner with all sorts of wineries and different things featured. The trade show continues through Thursday. The registration is still open on Thursday until 4 o'clock. The trade show goes until 3:30. At 5 o'clock, they still have shops going on and stuff. So it's really is a fantastic show. Like I say, I wish I could break away and attend it this year. Just can't do it. Getting close to doing some bobbing.
I'm looking at the photo on their main page. That place is packed. There's a lot of people there.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah,
it is phenomenal. They have lots of people attending, and the trade show itself. You don't have to attend the seminars. If you want, you can just go to the trade show itself. Early booking, I think you can still get in the early booking, and it's just $510 for everything. That includes all the seminars, all the shows, all the dinners, everything that they have. $510. It's in Richmond, Virginia. There's all sorts of stuff around Richmond, Virginia. This is the 36th year that they're doing this, so it's been going on for quite some time. But if you're an amateur winemaker and you want to just learn a little bit about wine, it's a great way to do it. You can go to the website. The website is wineriesunlimited.com/conference. Underline highlights or just conference, wineriesunlimited.com/conference, and that will take you to just about everything you want to see about and all that. So if anyone's out there listening, you want to attend the trade show, it is a great event, a fun event, an informative event. You meet some great people. I still am in contact with a lot of the people that I originally met when I attended the shows, and it just... people in the wine business, as you've already discovered if you listen to this show, people in the wine business don't mind talking about wine, and be it wineries or people who are involved with the wineries or cork people or whatever. They don't mind talking about the wine. And it's a fantastic show. I can't say enough about it. And the biggest on the East Coast, which makes it even better. You don't have to travel all the way out to California to attend some of these great seminars or to check out different things that you might be looking at purchasing if you're wineries or if you're an amateur and you want to get into some of the stuff. So that is wineriesunlimited.com, WINEREIESUNLIMITED, wineriesunlimited.com. Wineries Unlimited is a great magazine, by the way, too. I love the magazine. Very, very informative magazine. But it's not called Wineries Unlimited. The magazine is Vineyard and Winery Management is the name of the magazine. And it's really one of my favorite magazines I receive. So, but wineriesunlimited.com, the conference that they're coming up, and that will be next week. And the reason I went to all that is because we might not have a speaker next week because of that show. A lot of people go to it. A lot of people from Pennsylvania go to it. Now, they might not go this year since it's being held in Virginia. It was like almost walking to it there when it was up in Pennsylvania, right outside of northwest of Philadelphia. But now it's in Richmond, Virginia. And so it's more centrally located this year, I think, for everybody being in Virginia. But good show. So spent more time on that than I had planned on, but that's okay because I wanted to talk about that, and I'm glad I was able to find that. But I want to talk a couple of things, too, before we get Carl on, our guest. Carl is going to be our guest tonight from Allegro Wines. He's actually not at the winery, but he is willing to come on and talk with us tonight, so that's great. Before we go get in touch with Carl, I want to talk about, we've mentioned this in the past, about noble grapes, the nine noble grapes. These are actually, the nine noble grapes are the classic grapes. These are the ones that are looked upon as the backbone of the wine industry, if you will. These are the ones that people are always talking about. These are the ones that have got a reputation. These are the ones that have been around. These are the ones that are used for blending. They're just the classic grapes that have been around for like forever. There's over 5,000 varieties of Vitis vinifera grapes, and the Vitis vinifera grapes are the ones you're so used to seeing and drinking in the wine bottles. You can refer back. Do our archives go back to when we were talking about grapes and the different grapes and all that, or was that when we were on the other
I don't know. I'll have to go back and check. I know we go back almost, 3 years here?
3 years, yeah. But
That might be.
We were almost a year on that.
We're on Talk Shoe.
Yeah.
I think we started on Talk Shoe, and then we were on. I forgot what the other one was.
Me too.
It was, that one that was. Anyway. Yes.
Yeah. That one.
I have to go back.
But
yeah, I know it would be on iTunes. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, we could go back and it would definitely be on iTunes because iTunes
might,
followed us.
Might pick that up off of iTunes and play it just as a program one night, and just because I've talked about grapes. I talked a lot about the different grapes and stuff, and I think it might have been right at the beginning. And that's why I was wondering if it was right at the beginning of the program when we were doing this. We've been doing this for about 4 years. We've been on BTR for 3. But that first year, we were talking about grapes, and we were talking about we had programs that just talked about the Cabernet grape. We talked about the different families of grapes, and we talked about all that stuff. And I think – I don't know. We're going to have to check that out.
We go back to 2009 – we go back to 2009 on here, January, February. I think we started all about wine here on May 21st, 2009. So, and then we go into wine bottles, Chardonnay, Riesling. Yeah, I'll have to keep going through here.
So it does look like we talked about the grapes there.
Yeah, I'm still skinning through it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can remember. That's thank you. But we talked about grapes in the past, and if we find that we didn't have it on BTR, then we just may throw the programs on here just to get it on archives, get it caught up.
Grapes and grape varietals.
There we go.
We have
okay.
Yeah. Part one was on August 6, 2009.
Okay. So maybe it was when we were on BTR that we talked about the grapes and all.
Right.
So
okay.
It might have been, when we were talking about other parts of the world when we were on the other program. Well, whatever. Okay. But go back and check out the archives if it's on this one. If it isn't, we will pull it up and from the old archives and put it on here so you can do it. But there are over 5,000 grape varieties in the world. The Vitis vinifera. A Vitis vinifera grape is the grape that you're so used to. There are basically five families of grapes. Vitis vinifera, Vitis rotundifolia, Vitis labrusca, Vitis mustangulus, which consists of one grape. And then there's another one. I always forget this one. I forget it now. I'm going to have to look that up and write it on my finger because that's the finger. I always forget what grape variety that is. But there's five families of it. And of these five families, the most common is the Vitis vinifera. And this is the big one. This is the ones that you hear about all the time. You drink, you buy. The others have, American hybrids and American grapes and different things like this. So the Vitis vinifera, 5,000 grape varieties, all the colleges around the country, all the colleges around the world are always trying to come up with new varieties of this. But there are nine of them that are considered by historians and the experts to be the classic grapes. There's four reds and five whites. These classic grapes are the backbone of wine. I want to go through these real quick here, just a quick little summary of it. We've talked about the classic grapes before, and it's always good and always fun to talk about them again. A Cabernet Sauvignon, obviously, this is the one you hear, is a remarkable grape for its wide range of structure. You can get a very light Cabernet Sauvignon. If you don't believe me, go down to Walmart and buy a Cabernet Sauvignon for $2.99. That is a light, soft, light-bodied Cabernet. And all the way to a full-bodied one that is just so strong it can walk across the room and pour itself into your glass. And they're also noted for their age-worthiness. Cabernets can age if made in the proper style for years and years and years. The Cabernet Sauvignon is the ones that are coming in the French Bordeaux region. This is the backbone of the French Bordeaux. And obviously California's Napa Valley. This is where you find the Cabernets that of classic distinction and of classic character. Merlot, this is thought of as a softer cousin of the Cabernet Sauvignon, basically possessing most of the same qualities and aromas and flavor components, but a little bit different, a little bit less oomph, if you will, behind the Merlot. Although Merlot is coming back, they're making some Merlots out there now that will blow your socks off. Everyone is aware of it, familiar with it, and they are available out there. Pinot Noir, of all the classic grapes, this is probably the most challenging to make. It is rather sensitive to climate changes and stuff. You get the right climate and stuff, you've got yourself a gorgeous grape. But as we've talked to wineries and wine people already, again, I refer back to some in Oregon. They were talking about the Pinot Noir and how it doesn't really grow well in the lower altitudes, but once you start getting up in a little bit higher altitudes and the different valleys up on the hills, it's just a beautiful, phenomenal grape. Go down to Paso Robles in Central California, and the hills and stuff there are putting out some absolutely gorgeous Pinot Noirs. You get a good vintage, you get a good climate, you get a good year, and Pinot Noirs are just almost impossible to beat. They are just full of character and full of body. And this is your classic Burgundy grape out of France, the Pinot Noir. The Syrah, as a noble grape, the Syrah has been around for quite some time. I've never looked at it as a noble grape, I suppose you could. The Syrah has more or less morphed into the next big thing in California, the winemaking. It's on restaurant lists everywhere. I think the reason for this is because of Australia. Australia came out with the Syrahs with a Z. We spell it S-Y-R-A-H, and we have for years here. The Australians spell it S-H-I-R-A-Z, so they changed the spelling a little bit. Basically, same grape. And because the Australians came out with it, the popularity of the Syrahs has just jumped through the roof. Everyone is familiar with it now. Everyone says, oh, that's an Australian grape. No, it isn't, but they've, I think, caused the popularity. Chardonnay, what can we say? This is the biggest selling wine in the country, if not in the world. It's been the most popular white grape for decades. It is the classic white grape. You can do oak to a Chardonnay and just brace up the flavors and stuff and just start getting a lot of oakiness and a lot of flavors into it, which, if blended well with the grape, gives you a wonderful taste. You can do an un-oaked Chardonnay. It brings out the flavors of the grape itself. I do an un-oaked Chardonnay. I do a little blend of an un-oaked Chardonnay at the winery, which people tend to enjoy. It's different than the oak ones. You can get a second fermentation on the Chardonnay, a malolactic fermentation. You can get a malolactic fermentation on any grape. Don't get me wrong. People say, oh, I love that butteriness from a Chardonnay. The butteriness is from a malolactic fermentation. A malolactic fermentation is possible with any grape. The Chardonnay actually is the one that made it popular. So the Chardonnay, big fruity wine, can be influenced with oak, or you can have it just stand on its own. Probably a style of Chardonnay will match with just about any one type or any type of food you want to put on the table. It's just really quite versatile. Grape, and it grows everywhere. Again, refer back to our programs. Listen to some archives. It seems like almost everyone we have ever talked to grows a Chardonnay. Chenin Blanc. The Vouvray region in France, the Loire Valley, this is a Chenin Blanc. It's usually dry, comes in a little bit drier style, but you can have it a touch of sweetness to the Chenin Blanc. Usually not, but some wineries do make it a little bit sweeter style, since so many in the population that drink wines do like a little bit of sweetness instead of that complete dryness. Dryness is not overpowering. It's very refreshing. The sweet Chenin Blancs, I like them both. I like the dry and the sweet. The sweetness has a unique flavor, unique taste, different than the Riesling. People sometimes get confused. If you give them a sweet Chenin Blanc, they immediately think Riesling. It isn't. It's really quite different in characteristics. Riesling itself is one of the noble grapes that's been around for a long time. It's the most noble of the white noble grapes. It's a very delicate flavors, but it can be quite intense. A lot of times the alcohol remains reasonably low in the Rieslings. People come into the winery all the time and say, oh, I love a Riesling. And I say, well, that doesn't really tell me anything. That's like saying, I love a hamburger. You can get one at McDonald's or you can get one at a steakhouse. You know, and they're both hamburgers, but there is a big difference. And it happens with a Riesling. You can pick up a Riesling at a store that is very dry, at a winery that's very dry. Virginia makes some beautiful dry Rieslings that I've had. We haven't got to Virginia yet, but they make some great dry Rieslings. And then the Riesling grape is usually the primary grape for the Eisweins in Germany, very, very sweet ones. So the Riesling has a versatility to it that can go from extremely dry to extremely, extremely sweet. So to say I like a Riesling doesn't really pinpoint or narrow down your taste. The Riesling is said to originate in Germany, but the Alsace region of France is really done well with it. And actually, and I've said this before, upstate New York, the Finger Lakes area. Finger Lakes area have the capabilities and have the the climate and everything to make world-class Rieslings. I would love to see them do more so. It is a wonderful grape and wonderful region to grow in that area. Sauvignon Blanc. This is another of the nine. The name Sauvignon Blanc comes from the French word sauvage, meaning wild. And its vines tend to grow very proficiently. You have to be careful that you don't get too much of a flower flavor or nose to the Sauvignon Blanc. It can very easily turn that way. Right now, New Zealand. If anyone says Sauvignon Blanc, I immediately think of New Zealand. New Zealand is coming out with some phenomenal Sauvignon Blancs. They have continued to do so. I discovered New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs a few years ago, and I'm just amazed. They are blowing just about everybody away with the Sauvignon Blanc. The France, the Loire Valley, also has produced Sauvignon Blanc for centuries, and they are doing, as always, a great job on it. The Sauvignon Blanc comes up with a little hay or grass or herby, green herb type nose to it, and just a herbaceous taste and everything. Sauvignon Blanc is like mowing a fresh field. It always reminds me of on that. A great grape, really. And Semillon, this is spelled S-E-M-I-L-L-O-N. Semillon is a white grape that really Australia has made noticeable again, just like they have the Syrah on the whites, the Semillon on the reds, the Syrah on the reds and Semillon on the whites. Australia's made it where they've made some great dry wines. They also take the Semillon and add a little bit of Chardonnay to it to puff up the body on it. The United States is the Semillon is usually blended with the Sauvignon Blanc to help boost it up, to round it out and all that. So, nine noble grapes, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Pinot Noir, Syrah, Chardonnay, Chenin Blanc, Sauvignon Blanc, and Semillon. These are the ones that are the backbone of the industry, it seems, and I've got this list. I want to go through it again quickly. I look on our archives. I think it might have a lot of information about grapes and stuff on that, too, because we did dedicate some programs to the archives or in the past that are in the archives on grapes. I think it's getting pretty much close to the time that we need to try to get it over to Carl, see if we can't get Carl on the program to join us here. I think Mike is out there. Oh, we do have Carl on the program, it looks like, right now. Carl's sitting over there waiting for me to invite him in. I guess he is in our green room right now. And so let's pop him in and see if he wants to come on into the program. Hello, Carl. Are you there? No, he's not. Nope. We have a problem. Well, we'll have to wait a second. Maybe Mike's still playing with him. Carl from Allegro Wineries. Oops, I need to go back into and get my winery up here that Carl is from, so we can look at that and see a picture of Carl possibly while we're talking to him, which is always fun. And there we go, Allegro. Allegro, lively in musical terms. Good name for a winery. Now, Carl has a blog and everything. Let's see if Carl is there with us yet. Oh, we got Mike
Carl's
here.
Ready.
Carl's
yep,
ready?
Carl's ready.
All right.
Right here.
Hello, Carl. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on. This is great. Oh,
and I'm glad you accommodated us. I understand you're in College Station now and you're not at the winery, but thank you for joining us.
Yeah, actually, I am still at the winery right now.
Are you?
Out over my vineyard, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. All right, great. Well, tell us about Allegro Winery.
Well, Allegro is kind of one of the more unique wineries in the state because it's one of the earliest planted vineyards we have. Originally planted back in 1973.
Wow.
Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon, if you can believe that.
Hmm.
So, as far as we know, it's one of the oldest commercial plantings on the whole East Coast, and it's definitely the oldest commercial planting in Pennsylvania for those grape varieties. And the winery's been was started back in 1980 by a couple musician brothers, and they ran it for 20 years. And then after one passed away back in 2000, my wife and I purchased it from the surviving brother. So I've been here about 10 years now. So,
oh, fantastic. That 2000, I opened the winery here in, you know, Florida Estates Winery in 2001. So you're ahead of me by about a year there.
Okay.
I like this. On your opening page here, I noticed you have, you'll find no big concerts here, no festivals, no trophies, just wine for over 30 years. Seriously. I like that.
Thanks. I take there's a little attitude with what we do here, just because it's kind of a brave new world as far as winemaking goes, being trying to do vinifera wines up here in Pennsylvania. Even though we've been doing them for 39 years here as far as growing the grapes, it's still a new idea for people that, you know, they, this far north, you can actually do, you know, Merlots and Cabs and things like that. So, yeah, that's kind of the tenor that we have for our winery.
Where is Allegro located? Where? What part of Pennsylvania?
We're in South Central. So if you're at all familiar with any parts of Pennsylvania, Harrisburg's kind of in the central part of the state, and we're about an hour south of there. We're actually about an hour north of Baltimore, too, if that's helpful.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're really close, like, to the wine.
West of Philadelphia, then. And,
yeah.
And between Harrisburg and Baltimore.
Yeah, about 90 miles west of Philadelphia.
Oh.
About 50 miles north of Baltimore.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So,
so it's an interesting climate here.
You draw up on a big group of people.
Yeah, we do. Although what's interesting is the Philadelphia folks tend not to come this far west. They tend not to cross the river, the Susquehanna River, which is a pretty historically significant river. Although these days, of course, we have bridges to go across it.
Yes,
but we do pull a lot of people from Maryland and Washington D.C. actually up here.
Oh,
you know,
very good.
Because we're within an hour's drive of Baltimore. So,
Do you still just make the Cabin Chardonnay, or have you expanded your wine list?
Oh yeah. We've had to expand. I mean, as most small wineries up here on the East Coast, you know, we have a pretty diverse wine list that goes along with our diverse clientele. So, although as most winemakers, I'd love to focus on, you know, dry premium wines. At a certain point, you realize you have to pay to keep the lights on in the winery. It's helpful to find something customers. Every customer who walks into your door enjoys. So,
I learned something years ago when we opened up the winery. I was told
that
you don't make wines that you like; you make wines that sell.
That's true. That's very true. I've got a friend here who's a winemaker who asked me once. He said, "What's the most important thing that a winery makes?" I told him wine, and he said, "Nope, profit."
Profit.
That's right. Winemakers make wine, but wineries make profits, and
that's the key
difference there. So you have to have the profits so you can continue to make your wine.
That's true. So tell us about each of your wines, if you will, quickly. Wow, you got a lot of them too. I just looked at your list here.
Yeah, it's kind of a shotgun approach. They're not always all on the list, you know, as far as what's available to purchase that day, but. For our premium wines on our drier side, we tend to focus on, we've got a Viognier and a Chardonnay, and usually a blend maybe of the two, and also a steel Chardonnay as well. We'll have a Rosé, especially after years like this last one, where we saw some rain at harvest. And on the dry side, we focus on Merlot and Cab Sauvignon, and then blends as well. And we'll throw a Riesling in. And we do a lot of French-American hybrids as well. They tend to make it kind of into our popular semi-dry, semi-sweet wines. Wines, you know, grape names like Saval, Cayuga, Traminette. And then, of course, we do have some Labrusca varieties that we blend in as well. So it's a whole nine yards, really, that kind of makes this place tick.
I see that. Cabernet Franc, you grow the Cabernet Franc there?
I grow a little bit of it. We make some Cabernet Franc here. It's a great blending grape. Back in 2009, I had a lot of on hand, so I made a varietal, and my customers really liked it, but I didn't, so I'm kind of in a quandary as to whether or not to continue to do that. So I'm a pretty firm believer that Cabernet Franc is not a varietal grape usually. It's a better blender. But my customers tend to disagree with me. So,
I have to too. I love a Cabernet Franc. I really do. I just, it just got some characters in it that you don't find in the Sauvignon or the Merlot or any of those. I really do like a Cabernet Franc.
That's true. I mean, there are some great characteristics. For me, it's tough for us to ripen. It's almost tougher to ripen that one over a Cabernet Sauvignon.
Oh, wow.
Because of some of the unripe characteristics really hang on to the very bitter end of the season. And so you really need to get them super ripe to really get rid of a lot of those. In the industry, we call them methoxypyrazines, those greenish, dill pickle kind of characters that you don't really want in a red wine. So, and there's a whole wide range there where it's not quite as, where you don't get those flavors, where it's just nice red fruit. But if you can get it past that into this, really, you can get some really deep, rich flavors. But that happens, once in a blue moon, really, for us. So I tend to use it more as a blender than a varietal for the most part.
Uh-huh. The oak you're using French on everything?
Yeah, just about. I've been pretty experimental with a lot of things. For a long time, we've been trying Pennsylvania oak as well. But even going back as far back as 1998, we started experimenting at this winery with Pennsylvania oak. And, there's a bunch of different types of American oak. As you probably know, predominantly they're from the Ozark area.
Right, but, Missouri, Arkansas, yeah.
Exactly. But there are some, there are a couple cooperages. In fact, there was even a Pennsylvania cooperage here for a while that was trying to use Pennsylvania oak. And we've used it with a bunch of wines. I think it goes pretty good with a couple of our hybrid reds. We do a Chamberson here. I think it does all right with that. But when you start talking some of the nicer reds, there's some flavor profiles with the Pennsylvania oak barrel, and that just doesn't quite match what I'm looking for stylistically with our wines.
Uh-huh.
So I end up going, unfortunately, with the expensive French route. But give me a couple of years, I'm going to start playing around with Hungarian barrels too.
If you're going to play too, check out Minnesota oak. I've talked to quite a few wineries around the country, and programs over the months and years, and quite a few of them have said that they've used Minnesota oak and have great results. They just absolutely love it.
Yeah, I have heard the same thing too. I've heard, I've heard people playing with Virginia and Oregon oak, not with a very great success. Pennsylvania oak, everybody's kind of been on the, they thought it was going to be really good, but I've given up on Pennsylvania, unfortunately, as far as an oak producer, which sounds like heresy being a Pennsylvania resident and a Pennsylvania winemaker, but it just doesn't seem to work with our grapes, unfortunately, at least not yet. Maybe 10, 20 years from now it will, when our cooper just figure it out. But yeah, I've heard great things about Minnesota oak, and you're right, I should look into that one again as well.
Yeah, I don't use oak on anything. I just go straight stainless steel, so everything's made and put into bottles. But Minnesota oak has gotten rave unsolicited reviews from just about everybody who says they've used it. So
I'll definitely keep that in mind. I mean, when you're making wine, you're looking for a wide palette of flavors, and the more variety you can have, I think, makes it the wine a whole lot more interesting,
Yeah,
it makes it a flavor you can't really put your finger on and you can't really figure out, and makes you want to take another drink of it, So that's kind of the point, I think.
You have a Merlot, I noticed, here on your list also. Is that growing there?
Yeah, we grow Merlot here. I'm a really big fan of Merlot for this region. As you're, I'm sure, well aware, all the wine regions of the world have figured out what grapes grow best in their region. And so far, Pennsylvania, I think, is best known for our Yingling beer more than any grape yet. So, I'm working on trying to get us to at least my little area here to try to focus a little bit on one grape variety. And the one I'm pushing right now is Merlot because, it's a mid-season ripener, and more importantly, people know how to pronounce the thing, too.
So that's true. Important. Well, not everyone yet. And we're still working on that.
Well, if they pronounce it Merlot, we just know that they're Merloted, right?
There you go. There you go. Your vineyards, how many acres do you have?
Well, we originally planted upwards of 17 acres. That was the original planting back in 1973. Because of the age of the vineyard, we've had to do lots of replanting. We've succumbed to a lot of viruses and things like that. So we were all the way down to 4, and now we're back up to about 6. And the original planting was high-tech, state-of-the-art planting back in 1973, which was 12-foot rows and 8 feet between vines, which was, the best that California could determine was, what we should be doing.
These days,
of course, yeah, exactly. Very classic. But these days we know we need to be planting much more densely. So our density is now up to about 1,350 vines per acre. And
wow.
So that's triple what it was. So it's taking us 3 times as long to, replant as we expected. But, you do what you have to do to try to grow the best grapes. And that's what we decided to do. So
your area there, what elevation are you? The vineyard, what elevation is it?
We're just shy of 700 feet, so we're not too high at this point. So we tend not to focus on grapes like Pinot Noir or Riesling because our nights tend to be pretty warm yet. In the summertime, our nights will be, we might dip down to 70 degrees in the summertime, which really promotes ripening overnight as well. Even though we have shorter seasons, our vines are working 24 hours a day, which makes up for that. So,
do you have any influence from rivers or streams or anything like that around there?
Actually, we do. Since we're not that far from the Chesapeake Bay, we do have a big pull, a lot of air drainage that comes across from the west and gets pulled right down to the bay, which is southeast of us. And so we get a lot of winds and things from the northwest that come whipping across the vineyard area, which is really great for us because, as you know, winds dry out vineyards and vineyards need to be dried out to keep the disease pressure down. So we're really blessed to have a bunch of winds that when they get too big, they'll knock vine rows over, as they did twice this last year. We had a hurricane at the end of the year, and we had a tornado earlier in the year, both of which knocked, 2 or 3 rows all the way over. But, you live with that, and you prop them back up and hammer the post back in and go back at it. So,
right.
Yeah.
I did that 8 years ago.
We had
four hurricanes go through, and pound the stakes back in and pound the stakes back in.
That was 2004. That was Isabel, wasn't it?
We had Jeannie, we had Charlie, we had Ivan and Francis.
They made it up here, but Ivan and Francis did.
Yeah, they made it up there. The others, I think, just went up to the middle of the country. So, you mentioned your temperature in the summer. How cold does it get in the winter? I mean, it can get real, real cold for a sustained period of time because it would freeze those grapes you're growing. So, what's your winter temperature lows and highs?
Yeah, good point. Pennsylvania, we were early on, we were told, you can't grow vinifera grapes. It's too cold up here. But, it's not as cold as you'd think. I've been here since 2001, and it's the lowest temperature I've seen is 2 degrees, and that was only for a day. So, that's well within reason. I've never seen it now. Bear in mind, back in 1993, we did sustain 3 days at minus 15, and that actually did knock out one of our hybrids and some Merlot, but the crazy thing is it didn't knock out our Chardonnay or Cabernet, which was right next to it.
Wow.
So, you have to wonder what goes on as far as low temperatures and things go. Of course, this year has been kind of wild because I think our low temperature was about 18 or 20 this year.
It's been a strange winter for everyone this year. Everyone I've talked to has talked about how warm it's been this winter, and it's an odd thing.
I'm a little frightened at this point. Our earliest bud break before this year was April 7th, and that was in 2010. And right now, I'm looking at bud break probably within the next 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
So we're 2 weeks ahead of the record we ever had, which was a week ahead of the other record. So I'm 3 weeks ahead right now, which is scary because, you know, you get one little frost and you're toasted for the whole year. So
yeah, you get frost in April. I mean, it happens.
I get frost in May. You know, May 8th we had a frost in 2010. I got singed. It was scary.
Oh,
so I've got seven weeks till I'm free of this. So I'm not going to sleep much, I don't think.
Yeah, that's a scary thing. Do you have anything? Do you have fans or smudge pots or anything? Or do you just pray?
I just pray at this point. I mean, this is only the second year this has ever happened to us, you know, and so we still think it's an anomaly, but it might be an anomaly that keeps recurring. So my only backup right now is I spent part of yesterday talking to a helicopter pilot.
Uh-huh.
So that's my only ace in the deck right now that I can draw on. And
he doesn't have to fly over; just sit there with the propellers on. That's all.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, he's not cheap though. So but
yeah.
Neither are grapes. So we just gotta, you know. Hopefully, I don't have to call in.
I know. Well, I'll cross my fingers for you too on that.
thanks.
Your soil. What type of soil do you have there?
Well, these are interesting soils. They're pretty. They're older soils in general. This from my area all the way to Philadelphia tends to be some of the older soils on the eastern seaboard. For us, I mean that's as far as really deep geologic formations. As far as our specific soils and the couple feet that the vines spend most of their lives in, it's a very schisty soil. There is a bunch of iron in it.
Wow.
We tend to have a low pH as well, not terribly low, but in the low fives, which,
wow.
You know, vines, you know, the guys who are growing vines in, you know, California, Central Valley, they're looking for a 6.5 pH or something.
Right.
That's a big fertile area. For us, we'd rather be much lower because it tends to change the focus of the vine from being really fertile and vegetative to more focusing on fruit. And so I like it at this level. Plus, it's really well-drained soil. So, so when we get rain like last year, you know, the soil drains really, really well and keeps the roots dry and so they don't soak up nearly as much water and create as much vegetation. So schisty and very well-drained with a low pH is what we have.
And that's good. It's the low pH hasn't, that you've noticed, affected your Merlots and your Cabs then?
No, it has. We're not that low. You start to see problems of different chlorosis issues. You know, they talk about that with Riesling specifically.
Right.
But you've got to really drop below 5 for that. And we're about 5.3 to 5.5.
Oh.
So we're still in a safe range right now. And it does work on vigor. It takes us a lot of times 3 to 4 years to establish a vine rather than 2 to 3 years. But, you know, it keeps the vines in manageable shape. If you go on the other side of the Susquehanna River in Lancaster, which is towards Philadelphia, totally different soils, much deeper, more vigorous, more fertile. But, you know, happy grapes don't necessarily make the best wine. So you got to, you know, the grapes have to suffer a little bit to get things done for you the way you want them to.
It's just, you know, the old thing where the areas starve the water from the grapes just to get stronger grapes. I mean, it just, you know, it's all sorts of methods you can use on that.
Exactly.
I'm going to jump back to your wines here. For a second here, I got sidetracked,
sure.
Which I do very easily.
Sure.
An apple cinnamon? You grow apples there?
I don't grow apples, no, but I've got a neighbor down the road here that does. They got a nice orchard, and they actually have a cider press as well. Yep, and I do a peach wine too, a peach and grape blended wine, and that's a different neighbor who's got a peach orchard and a peach press, and you know, try to stay as local as we can.
Uh-huh.
Things. So I don't necessarily look at the state lines as being a regional, that, you know, demarcation. You know, if I have to go to Maryland to get something, you know, Maryland's only 10 minutes away from me. So
I try
to stay as local as I possibly can with things.
Oh, well, that's good. That's, you know, your sweet wines. Your residual sugar is high, or you try to keep it right around 3?
No, they get pretty astronomical at times.
Do they?
You know, Well, I usually don't divulge exactly how sweet they are, just because it's pretty amazing how people sweet people's palates will get before they like things.
No, it isn't.
But but if you look at like Pepsi. Pepsi used to be around 7% residual sugar back before when they used to use actual sugar,
right.
You know, and that's what people grew up with. So, you know, that's kind of a sweet spot for people. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah. You know, people like, you know, the people come in and say, I like a sweet wine. I said, well, it's hard for me to judge your sweetness level. And I had these bunch of old people come in the other day, sweet group of people. But they came in and they said, you remember Mad Dog 2020? I go, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You know, let me add some sugar to everything I've got. Okay.
Oh, man. I know. It's pretty amazing what people like. But, you know, we'd like to say in this part of the world, 90% of this country drinks sweet wines. And it's just the other 10% of us make them feel bad about it, you know. So, but, you know, we know the secret to keeping our sales going, which is, you know, make some sweet wine for folks. And it keeps them happy and it keeps us happy. So, and it works.
You got to do it. I know. You got to do it. And that's just it. I have my share of sweet wines, as does everyone. I had a quick story here with you. I had a Frenchman come in one day, and he goes, your wines are too sweet. No, they're not really not. I only have a couple of them above 3% residual sugar. He said, your wines are too sweet. And I go, no, my wines sell. And he goes, well, if I had a winery, I'd make mine the way I like them, big and dry. And I said, and you would be running out the door saying, bring it back. I'll pour sugar into it so you can buy it.
You know? That's true.
Because, that's, you know, true. You know, you know, you have to make it for the people, you know.
That's true. Yeah, my wife and I actually have an agreement that we did came across years and years ago, that there's kind of a price point. If the wine is under $13 a bottle, I make it for everybody else. If it's above $13, I make it for my tastes.
There you go.
You know, and the majority we sell is under $13 a bottle, but at the same time, it kind of keeps me happy and keeps my customers happy too. So. Yep.
Well, you have the ones that satisfy everyone. It looks like your list here is a very versatile list for just about everybody. I noticed you have one here that says in the style of an ice wine. Is that your peach one?
No, it's one wine called Aria that we do. And it's an ice. Well, we use ice wine. You know, you can't say real ice wine unless you let the grapes freeze out in the vineyard. And it's actually too warm here for that. But it's technically more of a Sauternes style wine, but most people aren't familiar with that, so that's why we use the word ice wine. So, but it's actually a cryo extracted wine. So we cryo extract it, the juice, and then we barrel ferment the juice, and we age it in old 10-year-old French oak barrels.
Oh wow!
And it's a really rich, concentrated, perfumed style of wine. It's you know, everybody's got a sweet tooth, and even dry wine drinkers have a sweet tooth, and it's a great, you know, sweet wine for a Merlot drinker. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
It sounds wonderful. It really does. Your sparkling wine, your Serenade, what style do you make that? I noticed the Tempranet grapes.
Yeah, Tremonette grapes is what we use. I mean, I'm such a big fan of champagne. I mean, I love drinking champagne, but we made some here for a while, you know, the sparkling dry Brut style wine. Right. And they don't sell to people. You know, I ended up drinking more of it than I think my customers did. So, you know, at a certain point, you have to figure out what the customers want. And they really want an Asti style of wine, you know, Asti Spumante. So that's my target for that. You know, every wine I make basically has a target. And Asti Spumante is my target for Serenade.
Uh-huh.
It works out pretty well. It works out pretty well, actually.
It seems... And you've got a price just about right too. I mean, it's not outrageous for people to get a sparkling wine there, so that they, they tend to gravitate toward that, I would think. Are you in an AVA there?
We're next to an AVA. There's actually a Lancaster Valley AVA, but no, we're not an official AVA. Even though we've been growing grapes here longer than most people in Pennsylvania, we haven't gotten ourselves organized enough to form an AVA yet.
How many wineries are around you?
We're in a wine trail called the Mason-Dixon Wine Trail, and it actually extends from northern Baltimore up to Harrisburg. It's more of a wine region almost. And if I last count, I think we've got about 16 wineries here. And just our county alone, I think, has 7 at this point. So we're one of the most populated counties in Pennsylvania for wineries at this time, which is nice for visitors coming through.
The Mason-Dixon Wine Trail, is it unique enough to apply for an AVA?
I think it is, just because of our soils. The question is, it would have to be an interstate AVA because it involves Maryland wineries, and I'm not sure how the TTB is on interstate appellations at this point.
They're relaxed their standards. There's quite a few of them around.
Oh, there are. Okay.
Yeah.
There's been a little bit of talk of doing it, but you know, most of us are so busy we don't have time to do it, and if it doesn't help sell wine at this point, I'm not sure that's going to help us to determine to do an AVA yet. But, you know, if somebody wants to do one, I'll help them out. But I don't have the time to do it, unfortunately.
And that is a good point, too. Most people don't understand what an AVA is. It's just something that you can say, oh, we are an AVA. But the average drinker, I don't think, really understands that.
Yeah.
Let's see, Wine Trail. You answered that you're in the Wine Trail. That brought me up something when you said the Pennsylvania state stores.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Is that? Yeah.
It's hard to understand, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Yeah, when we first started talking about Pennsylvania, we had trouble getting guests on, and I just blanketed a bunch of you to hope you get on. And again, thank you for joining us. But
sure.
I spent the first program talking about the state stores and not really understanding how it works and why it works.
Well, it works because, after 1933, after Prohibition ended, the way they got it to end was they allowed each state to determine how they wanted to handle alcohol.
Right.
And Pennsylvania decided to clamp down, and they wanted the government to control everything. And so the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board was created, and it controls the distribution, so they're the wholesaler, and it controls the retail stores of wine and spirits. So they're 2 out of the 3-tier system right there.
Wow.
And they are a monopoly, except for the limited farm wineries, which I'm one. You know, so we're kind of outside of their system a little bit. But if you want to buy any kind of alcohol that's not beer, you'll need to go to a wine and spirits shop. There's about, I think, 650 of them throughout the state. And the selection is the same almost in almost every single store, and the prices are the same through almost every single store. they have some pre – I know. I'm not from Pennsylvania, so it took me a long time to figure this out myself. And I question myself why I'd want to actually stay in this state, but it's a really great place to make wine. But purchasing fine wines is a real struggle sometimes if you're going to try to do it legally. So
he said softly. Well, so you said you are a farm winery. There's like 147 wineries in the state of Pennsylvania. They all are not farm wineries?
They're all farm wineries, yes.
Okay.
They're limited farm wineries, what we're called, and which puts us kind of puts us in agriculture, which is a good place for us to be.
Right.
Yeah, and it makes us seem less, you know, I'd like to tell people we are the sexy side of farming.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And people like that. You know, legislators like to talk about agriculture and think in terms of wine instead of hog farms, you know, and that helps.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And almost every state, they throw the wineries in agriculture, which is cool. You know, I mean,
yeah,
I like that. So that way you can sell out of the winery. Can you sell directly, though? I mean, are you limited in what you can sell?
I can sell wines and alcoholic ciders up to 200,000 gallons per year, which none of us are even close to that. And 200,000, yeah. And yes, we can direct to consumer, so we have retail sales here. And on top of that, they do allow me to have different stores, and I actually have about 5 different outlets.
Oh, really?
Other than my own winery. Which would make a lot of sense if you actually saw where Brogue, Pennsylvania was. We may be an hour from the Inner Harbor of Baltimore, but it takes me 25 minutes to get to the nearest grocery store. So we're really out in the middle of nowhere. And this is not wine drinking land. In fact, my township is actually a dry township. So, you know, we have to take our product elsewhere to really, you know, move the kind of volume that we'd like to move to stay here in on our little farm.
Can you taste there at the winery?
We sure can. Yeah, we can taste. People can purchase. They can drink wines here on site. So,
but you said you're a dry county,
dry township, which is part of it's in the county, but just a township, which is I don't know, 50 square miles down here in this part of the county.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering how. So, well, that's your state government. Obviously, your state government is pretty much wrapped that up as far as alcohol and everything goes. How does the state government treat wineries, though? I mean, do you love them, hate them, want to hug them, want to kill them? What?
Well, if you're a larger winery and you can get into their system, it's kind of a nice system because you can just talk to one entity, and if you get into the system, they put you in 600 different stores.
Wow.
You know, which is, you know, kind of like getting into Walmart or something like that.
Yeah.
But that only about maybe 10 of the wineries in the whole state are capable of doing that. The rest of us, you know, struggle trying to, you know, get our product into different restaurants and basically go the normal route without any kind of distribution. You know, most states, if you want to sell volume, you find a distributor who will work with you and distribute your product.
Right.
In Pennsylvania, if the distributor, which is the government, doesn't want your product, then you're kind of stuck trying to do it on your own.
So you don't have to have a distributor's license, though.
Well, yeah, we don't have, but also I can't sell in a retail store except for my own, and they limit it to 5. So I can't go over to, most wineries can't just go into a local wine and spirits shop and talk to the manager and say, here, carry my product. That just doesn't work. So you have to go through Harrisburg, and they have to okay everything. So it makes it more difficult if you're still a small winery, it makes it very difficult to get your product distributed.
Wow. So you have 5 stores, so you're maxed out is what you can.
I'm maxed out. I am, yes.
Oh, wow.
that's all they'll let me in. So that's the way it goes. So we'll see. At some point, you know, these things may change, you know, depending on how, people are starting to see that Pennsylvania wineries are starting to gain a lot of momentum and popularity with our locals. And, you know, we can work on getting some of these laws changed, you know, and hopefully we can at some point. But at this point, it looks like the liquor control board system, as it stands, is probably going to stay this way for who knows how long yet.
Yeah. So, wow.
Yep.
So shipping, can you ship?
We can ship, actually. We can ship to Pennsylvania residents. Back, you know, when Granholm Hill came through, it was always a big question whether or not we could ship, or whether people could ship in. And Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board did not want to have out-of-state wineries shipping to Pennsylvania residents because that kind of circumvented their monopoly.
Right.
But because we were already shipping, they decided they were going to try to take away our right. And turns out our right was given to us by legislatures, not the Liquor Control Board. And so we were able to retain our right to ship to Pennsylvania customers.
Good.
Yes, it was a real, real great coup for us to be able to retain this. And then, of course, at this point, that also means that out-of-state wineries should be able to ship as well. But at this point, there's no law in place. So the law that banned out-of-state wineries shipping in was struck down, but there's no new law in place. So it's kind of extra legal at this point.
I see. So you can't ship outside of the state of Pennsylvania?
Well, I could do that as well with permitting and things. Yes. I tend not to because the permitting process for each state is, pretty onerous.
Yes.
Except for Florida. Florida seems to be pretty open to things.
We are, yeah. they're not scared of other wineries. I don't know why. But
yep.
So is there a state, a winery association or something that is fighting for you guys, or is there any type of state association?
Yeah, there is. Yeah. We actually have two kind of organizations. One is our Pennsylvania Winery Association. It's been around for about 35 years, I think.
Wow.
And we have lobbyists who work for us, a lobby group that works for us, and they do marketing for us as well. And then there's a second organization called the Pennsylvania Wine Marketing Research Board, which is where is a commodity board where excise tax that is imposed on all the wineries is collected and sent to this commodity board, which then uses the funds for grape and wine research and for marketing dollars as well.
Uh-huh.
So it works pretty well for us. I'm actually the vice chair of that board, so I get a chance to take a look at all the proposals that come through and, you know, make sure that we're trying to move our state in a forward direction and increase wine quality and wine sales and things like that. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
So, Mike, do you have any questions you'd like to ask Carl before he tells us about the winery and all that good stuff?
I was just curious about your venue. What kind of, do you have events there on site? Or I noticed on your website you have, the Mason-Dixon Wine Trail, 5 weekends in March, March 3rd through April 1st. That's one. Do you have anything like concerts or special events going on there at the winery?
Yeah, actually, we don't. We try to steer pretty clear of those kind of things and focus more on winemaking. We do have these wine trail events that we do the weekends in March, and we also do them in November as well. We do a couple of them around a Nouveau, like a Nouveau release kind of idea. So we do those, but for the most part, I let all the other wineries try to be nightclubs, and I just focus on growing grapes and making wine. It's less of a headache for me that way.
Yeah. You don't do anything then? You don't do weddings, receptions, any of that stuff?
No, I don't.
Oh, good for you.
I'm a winemaker and a grape grower, and you know I've got a few guys to help me in the production side, and I've got a sales staff that helps it up into our stores and things. But you know, I got into winemaking because I was a winemaker and a grape grower, and I didn't want to have to get into the event entertainment side. And so far, we've been able to avoid it. So, you know, maybe someday I'll have to go back, but we'll see. I like it this way the best.
But another question I just thought of too, when Mike was asking there, if I may interrupt, Mike, when do you usually harvest?
We've seen harvest as early as August 25th for early varieties, but usually it's the first week of September. We get some stuff in, and harvest will last usually up until about the fourth week of October.
Wow, so, big harvest! Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a long harvest, and it's my favorite time of the year. So.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you know it's getting cold.
It's like Christmas for winemakers. You know, you open up your the bin of grapes, the tub, and you say, like, what do I get to play with for the next year? You know, all your hard work's paying off.
That's true. That's always fun. Well, Carl, give us all the information. Mike, you have any other questions?
Nope. No, I'm good. Go ahead.
Carl, give us all the information about Allegra Winery, where it is, if you want to list all 5 stores, you know, be my guest, your email address, how people can get a hold of you, website, all that good stuff, Facebook if you have it, everything. So if anyone wants to get a hold of Allegra Winery, they can.
Sure, no problem. Our website is AllegraWines.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter under Allegra Wines as well. Our email address is info@allegrawines.com. And we're located at 3475 Seacrest Road in Brough, Pennsylvania, 17309. And we even answer the phone sometimes at 717-927-9148. So email's a lot better for us because, you know, we can do that on our time, so.
Yes,
that's what we have.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking your time out to join us on the program. And when I am in Pennsylvania, actually, I have a brother-in-law in Baltimore, just outside of Baltimore. And next time I'm up there, I will make the short drive up and visit you.
You're more than welcome here. Make sure you let me know before you show up. I'll make sure I'm here. I'm down by the winery. I can share some wines with you. So. It's been a pleasure talking with you tonight.
You also. Cool. Thank you very much. Have yourself a good evening now.
You too. Take care.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
All right.
Very cool. Yeah, very good.
Yeah, he's very interesting.
There you go.
Yeah.
They're a little late.
I forgot I had opened the window.
That was enjoyable.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very informative. He did a great job of explaining the Pennsylvania liquor stores to us, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's odd.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Well, we told people
somebody to explain it. There you go. That's explained. Wow.
Yep. Interesting. Okay.
So we're done. Nothing this weekend at the winery. We have a couple of classes. We have one Saturday and one Sunday from 1 to 4 on each day. 2 to 5. Uh-oh. I would just... I'm sorry. My engineer was just informing me of some stuff here. I said the wrong time. It's 2 to 5, not 1 to 4.
Okay. 2 to 5 Saturday and Sunday?
Saturday and Sunday. 2 to 5 Saturday and Sunday. And so if anybody's looking at attending the wine class, we got openings. You can get in touch with us. We can get you in there.
Good. Okay. Let's see. Next week we will be on again, which would be... Oh, boy, I got to pull this. The 29th. February
29th. I don't know if we have guests or not. Maybe. I don't know. I've been talking to a guy. I'm waiting for an email back from him. He might be available with us next week. If he is, we will get him on. But like we said at the beginning of the show, possibly a lot of people will be going to the Wineries Unlimited convention, and if that's
right.
The case, you know, we might not have
If we were doing our road tour, we could probably have joined them, but unfortunately we're not doing the road tour yet, so
that would be fun to do a road tour to
wouldn't it? And go to all the events and everything, set up a little booth.
Anybody out there wants to sponsor us,
absolutely. That's right.
We are not adverse to being sponsored. Being kept in.
Yes. That would be cool. Well, I guess we can I'll close out with the contact information as always, and I have to grab some stuff here. You can unless you have anything else to add, did you go ahead and do the Facebook information and my other stuff, which is somewhere around here. Be sure to go to Facebook and like our show page on Facebook, which is at facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr, and show your support of the show. And plus, we keep you updated on what's happening. I know you're in there all the time doing updates and who you're talking to and things like that. And I actually got on there while you were talking to Carl and posted some things as well. As he was talking, so I got some of that in there, and so that was kind of cool. You can also follow the show on Twitter. We have a Twitter account, so get on Twitter and go to twitter.com/allaboutwinebtr. It's real simple. It's on Facebook or Twitter, the same /allaboutwinebtr for both of those, okay? So do that, and be sure to follow the show. We'd appreciate it, or like the show on Facebook. And you can email the show, allaboutwine101@gmail.com, allaboutwine101@gmail.com. So that covers the show. The winery, Florida State's winery, is open daily from 11 a.m. until 6. This is the recorded part, by the way. Open daily from all this stuff. I've been repeating this since 2009. Well,
2009, yes.
The winery is open daily from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. You do tastings and retail sales there. You got a great gift shop, and plus all your wines and everything there. Fantastic. Stop in and visit and sample some world-class wines, definitely, at Florida State's Winery, located at 25241 State Road 52, that is in Land O'Lakes, Florida. If you go I-75 to exit 285, you want to go west about 4 miles on State Road 52, and you'll see the signs there. You can also get there from US 41, the Suncoast Parkway, and US 19. Just go east on 52, and before you get to I-75, you'll see the signs there. You're past US 41. A distance, but it'll
about 8 miles.
You'll see the signs. About 8 miles west, miles east of, yeah, east of U.S. 41 on State Road 52, and you'll see the signs there. For more information, you can also telephone 813-996-2113. That is for Florida State's Winery, 813-996-2113, or email corp, C-O-R-P, at floon.com, F-L-E-W-N.com. And be sure to visit the website at www.floridaestateswines.com for more details. Sign up for the newsletter, and everything is on there as well. So floridaestateswines.com, and fantastic. And, you know, come out underneath the oak trees sometime, even though it's getting a little warmer. It's great shade underneath the oak trees to sit outside and just enjoy a glass or bottle, you know, whatever. Have a picnic, pet-friendly and family-friendly. So step on out and enjoy it. So
we'll look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we will see you all next week on the 29th at 7 p.m. We don't know who we'll have on here, but...
No, I... We'll maybe, maybe Salvatore.
Okay.
But we'll see. Hopefully he'll be able to join us.
Okay. Very cool. Thank you all, and have a great rest of the week. And we'll see you all next Thursday right here on Blog Talk Radio. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mike. We'll, thank you. And thank everyone. See you next week.
Thank you. All right.